Welcome to this special presentation of the unabridged audiobook of Afterlife, A Rainy Day Investigation, on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs fiction podcast. Afterlife was inspired by a real-life investigation conducted by co-author and parapsychologist Lloyd Auerbach that was the case that made him believe in ghosts. Although Afterlife is book two in the series, you can enjoy it as a standalone story. However, you'll likely also want to listen to Near Death, the novel that introduces Dr. Jennifer Day, anthropology professor and parapsychologist, to her skeptical partner, former police detective Nate Rainey. In Afterlife, Danny, a young boy, makes friends with the ghost of a woman, Maureen, who used to live in the house his family has moved into. He's the only one who can see and hear her. Maureen died 15 years earlier, trying to make her escape from a botched bank robbery, at which time she hid millions of dollars in cash and valuables. Unfortunately, she can't remember where. But that's not going to stop her old partners from doing everything they can to find their long-lost treasure, no matter what the cost. If you enjoyed this free presentation, I hope you'll take a minute to post a review on Amazon, Audible, and Goodreads, as well as your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to listen to Near Death, along with my weekly short stories, here on Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs. And now, Part 17 of Afterlife, A Rainy Day Investigation, by Rich Hosick, Arnold Rudnick, and Lloyd Auerbach. Afterword. In the scheme of things, most people don't distinguish between what we, versed in studying the paranormal, call ghosts and hauntings. You see a figure standing in front of you, or hear voices coming out of nowhere, or even sense a presence, or feel like something is off in a space you've just entered. You say the place is haunted, and might even say that there are spirits present. But over the 140 years since the scholarly and scientific study of all things psychic phenomena related was officially started with the founding of the Society for Psychical Research, we've naturally learned a thing or three about many things considered ghostly and haunted. First of all, there is a difference between a spirit of someone who has died, what we typically call an apparition, less cultural baggage than the term ghost, though they can be used interchangeably, and a place or object that is haunted. If we are truly talking about an apparition, ghost, or spirit, we're talking about someone's consciousness surviving the death of their brain and body, and having the capability to still be aware of and interact with our physical world and us. Consciousness is paramount here for the understanding of what a ghost is, and interactivity, and at least apparent self-awareness, supports the entity being conscious. When using the term haunting, often used with a qualifier, and stated as residual haunting by some of the paranormal reality show folks, we're not using the term to refer to a conscious entity. The concept is that the environment, the land, the house, or object store information of activity and emotions that happened in and around them. Living humans, and we think animals, of course, have the capability to pick up snippets of this recorded information from the environment. The information gets interpreted by our perceptual processes and added to our normal perceptions, kind of like adding a background on a Zoom call. Whether this is a form of ESP or some biophysical thing happening between our brains and something in the environment has not yet been determined. People experience this information residue in many situations without ever saying the place is haunted. One example being when we go house or apartment hunting. We walk into a place and get a vibe, a sense of good or bad emotion, an energy. Nothing to do with the decor or smell. That emotional imprint comes from the people who live there, or even still live there. If it's bad vibes, we leave and continue our hunt for a new place to live. The information can be translated in our heads to emotions, the most common, or visuals, or sounds, or voices, even smells and physical sensations. Objects can also hold such emotions and other information for us to perceive. For what is a house? It's a big object we enter instead of touch or hold in our hands. One last important point about the recording that hauntings hold. The living leave the imprints, not the dead. Yes, many places we call haunted are old and no longer have people living there, with the people who used to live there perhaps being long dead. And yes, places where a murder was committed or a suicide happened can be haunted by the emotion, and even other kinds of perceptions, related to the murder or suicide. However, just because someone died there does not mean the death or manner of death was responsible for any information residue. Consider a movie like Frankenstein, released in 1931. I'm a sucker for the old Universal monster movies. When the movie was filmed, everyone in it was fully alive. However, since then the majority, if not all, of the people on screen have died. Yet I can watch that movie whenever I want on DVD or streaming. I am watching a recording of people who are dead, yet who made that recording when they were alive. It's the same with a haunting. The information we pick up was imprinted into the environment by living people, though for some it's from living people in the process of dying, but not dead yet. There are hauntings on record of people even seeing ghostly figures, which turned out to be images of themselves. One last point before I move on to discussing the main phenomenon of this novel, apparitions. The word haunt refers typically to places. It is not uncommon to hear a character in an old detective mystery movie say something like, "We need to check the killer's old haunts." Living people haunt their regular hangouts. You're even haunting your own home and place of work or business. Regular customers of bars and restaurants are technically haunting the place while alive. Norm and Cliff haunted the bar on the TV sitcom Cheers. In other words, anyone who spends a lot of time in a place is technically in their old haunt. So yes, apparitions, ghosts, can haunt a place, but we don't call that a haunting per se, mainly because that seems to be a choice. Apparitions can and do move from place to place on occasion, but at least in the U.S. and other Western countries, they hang around in places where they had a real emotional connection when alive. What that means is that when someone dies and sticks around after death, they seem to stay within their home or appear in a place they had an association with when alive. In most cases, that's a positive association and, other than their former home, could be a bar, restaurant, hotel, or other place they might have spent a lot of time. Whether they died there or not is irrelevant. It's about the association from life. So, if they died in that bar or restaurant, they might hang out there after death, or might head home. I do want to mention a few more tidbits here, before moving on to discuss the case I had that inspired the main ghostly interactions in the story you have just read, or maybe are about to read. An apparition is our personality, or spirit, soul, consciousness, mind, or whatever you want to call it, surviving the death of the body, and capable of interaction with the living, and presumably other apparitions. It is pure consciousness. Apparitions are seen, heard, felt, or smelled, thankfully not tasted, by people through the process of ESP, extrasensory perception. Not a sixth sense, but rather something extra, a perceptual process that does not involve the physical senses. It seems our own ESP allows us to perceive them in different ways. And yes, we all have some degree of ESP, unless we're totally blocking it, usually related to fear and or belief. The model of an apparition is that it is consciousness without form. As the apparition has no form and no sensory organs or normal ability to communicate, he or she essentially connects to the minds of living people. The apparition essentially broadcasts sensory information, what he or she looks, sounds, feels, and smells like, to the minds of us living folk. Our minds process the signals and add them to what our normal senses are picking up. Some people do better with visual input, some with auditory, or other kinds of information. Some can process combinations. It's an individual thing. But because they have no physical form, they are not seen with the eye or heard with the ears as such. It's why in a crowded room with lots of living people and a ghost, some see the ghost, some hear him, some feel his presence, some smell his cologne, and some get different combinations of those perceptions. And of course, lots of people in the room may get nothing at all. This is also why ghosts generally can't be photographed. They don't reflect or give off light to affect our eyes or cameras. If a ghost could appear in a picture, it would be because the apparition consciously affected the film or digital media, not because they simply appear in a bright flash, which is absolutely not the case. In other words, the apparition affects the picture media with his or her mind. By definition, this is psychokinesis, PK, or mind over matter. PK is also how an apparition could move an object, or even create a recording of a voice inside a voice recorder, what's called electronic voice phenomenon, or EVP. When one sees or otherwise perceives a ghost, we in parapsychology have to figure out if what's perceived represents an actual conscious entity or is a haunting. The distinction is related to interaction. Since recordings typically do not react or interact to us or show any indication of self-awareness. One way I can get this point across is to bring up the old ghost stories. Let's say we have that old haunted Scottish castle where the Lord of the Manor, who died some 300 years ago under tragic circumstances, of course, appears on the parapet every night at midnight, playing his bagpipes naturally. You see him coming towards you. Needless to say, you're starring as the intrepid investigator here. He reaches your position, then walks right through you. And night after night, he goes through the same motions, playing the same tune. That's either a haunting, a replay from the past, or a very boring ghost. Perhaps he has OCD. Should he stop one night, however, and ask if you have any favorite songs you'd like to hear on the bagpipes, well, you've got yourself a real live ghostie. One important additional bit of information about apparitions is that there are numerous reports of apparitions of still living people. Often those people are having an out-of-body experience at the same time as they're being perceived as apparitions, or they're having dreams about visiting the persons who see them as apparitions. Sometimes the apparition is generated by a person in some sort of immediate danger or crisis. It's as though the apparition is projected to get help for them. It is clear that the vast majority of encounters with apparitions happen at or within a couple of days of the moment of death of the person represented by that apparition. After that, they're gone to whatever the next stage of existence is, called the afterlife or the other side by most people. Some few seem to stick around longer, and there are a number of personal reasons why this might be, a range of reasons that reflect the individual person. After being around this field for over 40 years, coupled with my own investigations, those of my colleagues, and the reports in our century-plus literature, I am of the opinion and belief that a personal desire or other reason to stay is not enough. Otherwise, I think we'd have a lot more such cases to investigate. It's likely that there are some connections to the physical environment at or after the moment of death, such as to the Earth's magnetic field. We also cannot eliminate that there may be something spiritual or even divine, that a greater power has something in mind for us, individually, when we die. Science cannot research such things as God or gods due to them being unknowable in nature. I don't personally believe this is the case or not the case. But it is something to consider. One other important piece here that is completely ignored by ghost hunters, it seems, except those who do have the curiosity and motivation to learn from the field that has been studying the paranormal since the 1800s, ghosts have ESP too. Without some form of non-sensory perception, apparitions could not perceive, see, or hear us or the physical world in general, since they do not have physical sensory organs to gather information. They don't physically make sound, otherwise everyone present could hear them, and recordings could easily be made of those sounds or voices. No voice box, no physical voice. Apparitions perceive the world and communicate using non-sensory or extrasensory means. As mentioned earlier, since they have no physical form per se, anyone seeing an apparition is perceiving some kind of self-image of that apparition. Since, with rare exception, we in Western culture think of ourselves as wearing clothing, and ghosts are people too, naturally that psychic image people pick up on has the apparition wearing clothes. And often, the ghost looks much healthier, younger, and even fitter than the people they were at the time of death. Close your eyes and get a picture of yourself in your mind, and you'll get what I mean. In communication with apparitions over time, people who have communicated with them, whether normal people or psychics or mediums, have learned that they don't have a real sense of the passage of time. After all, they have no body clock, no real need to eat, and apparently no need to sleep. I say apparently, because the ghosts in the wonderful CBS and BBC TV show Ghosts do apparently sleep at night, but that's pop culture for you. In some very few cases, the apparitions have learned to move things, or otherwise affect the physical world. As they have no bodies with which to do this, we can say they're interacting with the physical via mind over matter, psychokinesis, or PK. As a pulp culture example, I point you to the 1990 film Ghost with Patrick Swayze, Whoopi Goldberg, and Demi Moore, in which Swayze's character has to learn from another ghost how to move something. On to the apparition case at hand. First, for a complete write-up of this case, please see my chapter Interactive Apparitions in Leslie Keene's 2017 book Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife, available in multiple formats. The intriguing call came into the office of the Graduate Parapsychology Program at John F. Kennedy University in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I was on faculty. This was not long after I received enormous national publicity in the fall of 1984 as a real-life Ghostbuster. Note, the Graduate Parapsychology Program ended in the late 1980s, and, as of 2021, JFK University has been folded into National University. I continue to teach parapsychology online through the Ryan Education Center, www.ryanedu.org, and Atlantic University, www.atlanticuniv.edu. The call came from a woman named Pat in Livermore, a city east of Oakland, California, less than an hour drive from where JFK University was. Pat was an attorney who lived in Livermore with her son and her husband. Her mother lived nearby. The call was prompted by her learning that her son had been having conversations with the ghost of the previous owner. She also learned that these almost daily conversations had been going on for well over a year, since shortly after they moved in. Pat's attitude was refreshing, as was her story. They had purchased the 70-plus-year-old home in an estate sale a couple of years after the death by natural causes of the owner. The woman, who was that previous owner, had lived in the house since her birth in 1917 until her death in 1980. Since moving in the house, Pat, as well as her husband and her mother, had seen the apparition of a woman appearing and disappearing in the house. But until her son mentioned his daily communications with the ghost, the others had not even admitted they'd seen her too. In other words, they'd all seen the ghost, but kept the sightings to themselves. Pat grew up in a family environment that acknowledged psychic experience and was not afraid of the ghost. One day, Pat's 12-year-old son, Chris, began talking about the origins of some of the antique furniture and some of the porcelain dolls they had also purchased in the estate sale. Pat asked if he had found some kind of paperwork about the items. Chris simply replied that, "Lois told me." Lois was the name of the late owner. Chris also let her know that the ghost, Lois, had told him that the other family members had seen her, but were not talking about the experiences. After Chris's revelation, Pat spoke with her husband and mother, and they all admitted to one another that they, too, had seen the ghost on several occasions. But it was Chris that Lois apparently felt most comfortable around and appeared to every day. Pat was curious about having a ghost in the house with a growing preteen. In fact, by the time of her call, she had already taken her son in to see a local psychological counselor to make sure he was okay and that it was not damaging to have him continue conversing with the ghost. With the family's permission, I had lunch with the therapist, who, he admitted, was a bit of an agnostic when it came to ghosts. However, he was convinced that Chris was well-adjusted and not prone to making things up, consciously or otherwise. I agreed to come check things out myself, and I was quite excited to do so. Pat stated that Chris was able to get verifiable information from Lois. This was a rarity when it comes to apparition cases. Pat did pass along a concern of Lois's about my visit, however, that Chris had passed on from Lois. Apparently, Lois watched television quite a bit with Chris, and had seen a commercial for Ghostbusters. She was worried we'd bring along blasters to get rid of her. I assured Pat that this was not the case. Driving with me from the university to Livermore were Joanna Ricks and one of the transpersonal counseling students, Kip Laser. As we drove to Pat's place, we talked about a number of things. A few in particular came back to haunt us in a way. The car I was driving was giving me problems, and I expressed ideas for a new car. Joanna was seriously contemplating quitting her job that week. Kip, we learned, had been a professional dancer for 10 years before coming back to school at JFK University. We arrived and were greeted by Pat, her mother, and Chris. Pat's husband was out of town at the time. As we were invited in, I got the impression Chris was giving us the visual once-over to make sure we had no ghost traps. We started a tape recorder and walked around the house, discussing the sightings of the ghost they had all had. Pat and her mother had seen the ghost on brief occasions. She always appeared as an elderly woman. Chris had been seeing her almost every day for more than a year. He told us she didn't always appear as an old woman to him. She often looked like a teenager, a six-year-old, a woman in her 30s, and sometimes middle-aged. Did her clothing change often? I asked. All the time, he replied. In fact, Pat and her mother also admitted to seeing Lois wearing different clothing. This was important to me, as was the appearance of Lois at different ages. I asked Chris how that was possible. He told us Lois believed she did not have a form. She believed she was some kind of ball of energy that was able to communicate by projecting her thoughts to others. These thoughts included visual and verbal information that she would project into the minds of others, so they would see and hear her as if she was really there. Remember, this was coming from a 12-year-old. This meant that Lois was aware that she was literally telling Chris's mind what to see and hear about her. They were not really seeing or hearing Lois. They were perceiving her, and both Lois and Chris were aware of this. Why was Lois appearing in different forms and clothing? I asked. Because that's how she felt that day, he replied. In other words, as indicated earlier in this afterword, it was Lois's own sense of self, her perceptions about the way she viewed herself that day, at a particular age, in particular clothing, that shaped her projection of herself. We finished touring the house, hearing about some of Lois's furniture and her doll collection, about the city of Livermore, and about Lois herself when she was alive. For a 12-year-old, Chris was an articulate purveyor of anecdote. In fact, I had little trouble believing someone else was feeding him the information. Was Lois there with us? Apparently, she was by Chris's side the whole time, or so he said. As we ended the house tour, we asked whether we could ask Lois some questions. We sat down in the living room, facing Chris, who was seated next to an empty chair he identified as Lois's favorite spot to sit. According to the boy, she was sitting there with us all. So the three of us pitched questions at an empty chair as a young boy looked and listened to someone sitting there, repeating or translating her answers. There was a surreal feel to the situation, like we were in some weird situation comedy. While Joanna and Kip asked questions more related to Lois herself, I pretty much kept to questions related to her current incarnation as an apparition. The answers we all got were specific and to the point. More and more information came out about Lois, giving us the picture that she was a local social butterfly, often hosting parties at her home throughout her life. Most of her relatives had died, but we were informed on one who was still alive. For me, Lois related, through Chris's excellent translation, more description of her form and ability to communicate on a telepathic level with Chris. She declined to appear to us. She still didn't quite trust us, she said, and admitted she wasn't even sure she really could. She related that others seeing her might also have to do with her current attachment to the house and how psychic they were. Most of what Chris told us Lois said about her form as an apparition was more than a bit familiar from my readings in parapsychological literature, not from books for the general public. This was not something I expected from a 12-year-old boy who, according to his mother, never read anything on ghosts. One of the more enlightening questions I asked was why Lois was still hanging around her old house, why she had not passed on. The answer was that she had done much socializing, had many parties in her life, and had not been an avid churchgoer. A believer in heaven and hell, she thought too much partying and not enough church might see her to hell, so she figured why not stick around rather than take the chance of ending up there. Besides, she told us, she liked the new family and felt very happy with them, especially Chris. From this, one cannot conclude that there is a heaven or hell, only that Lois believed there was. However, we could infer that her belief and her desire to remain somehow enabled her to stay as an apparition in her home. As mentioned above, it is unlikely it's only a desire on the part of all who die that's enough to allow everyone to be here as a ghost, as there were also most likely some environmental factors and some person-specific factors that allowed Lois to stay. Otherwise, we would have many more apparition cases than we do. I finally asked if Lois had any questions for us. Lois decided to show off. Chris looked to the empty chair, then asked us each a question. Lloyd, she wants to know if you've decided on a color for that car you want. Joanna, have you really thought about the kind of job you want after you quit the one you have? Kip, how long were you a professional dancer? I think our jaws probably hit the floor at the same time. We each, in hollow voices, answered the questions. Then, after telling Pat and the others that the questions related to our in-transit conversation, I asked how Lois knew to even ask the questions. Chris looked over to the chair, then back at us a bit sheepishly. You're probably not going to like this, but Lois wanted to make sure you weren't bringing blasters to get rid of her, so she hitched a ride with you here and eavesdropped. We all got a big, though nervous, laugh out of that. Kip was especially shaken, since the only place Lois could have sat was next to him in the back seat. We got up to leave, promising continued contact and follow-up. We did go through the tapes to listen for any indication that we somehow told them about our previous conversation. We concluded that either Chris or Lois read our minds, or that my car was bugged, or that Lois really caught a ride with us. To this day, I'm sorry it didn't occur to me to ask how Lois got to JFKU to get into my car in the first place. Did she hitchhike there? Take a bus? Fly? Sometime afterwards, Lois's only living relative was tracked down. I spoke with the elderly gentleman, who was able to verify the tales of Lois's youth as true, as well as information and stories about the family and Lois's house that Chris came up with. In case you're wondering, Pat did thoroughly check to see if Chris had somehow found diaries or other papers Lois might have left behind. None could be found. Chris continued to see Lois on a daily basis for a while, but then lost interest as he grew and discovered, and was discovered by, real girls, though he apparently asked Lois for advice on many occasions. I continued to follow up with Pat through the early 2000s, and Lois was still in the house, still seen on occasion by members of the family, and still apparently happy to be staying in her lifetime home. This case is my favorite on many levels. First, the verified information was enough under the circumstances to convince me that normal sources of information could be ruled out. Lois was there, or perhaps Chris was some kind of super psychic who was able to pick up the information from the house itself through clairvoyance or retrocognition. That there were other witnesses to Lois puts heavier emphasis on the former possibility rather than the latter. Second, the information about how Lois was able to appear and communicate was far beyond what most people would be able to read about easily at the time, let alone the kind of information that a 12-year-old would spout about ghosts. Third, that the family called us in because they, too, were curious about apparitions was refreshing and enabled us to ask the kinds of questions I like to ask about the how and why of apparitions. Finally, that the family was well-adjusted, seemingly without psychological issues about the ghost, was very encouraging to someone like me, who so often encounters people whose first impulse when they see a ghost is to turn and run. Lois showed herself to be a person first, and a ghost second. She proved my adage that ghosts are people too. Cases like this exist all over the world, though unfortunately my colleagues and I rarely get to visit and dig deeper into them. Most people wouldn't think to call for a parapsychologist or other paranormal investigators when they have a friendly ghost or even a positive imprint type of haunting. It's generally only when one is afraid, angry, annoyed, or otherwise put out that one calls for help with psychic experiences or encounters, or for plumbing for that matter. One last thing. That squirrely case Jennifer Day investigates in this book is also based on one of my own experiences. In the actual case, I sat on the rough attic floor waiting for something to happen. It is one of the only cases I've ever done where I did so at night with the lights out, as that was the condition of the attic when the couple heard the ghostly footsteps from the floor below. I actually heard scratching and light thumping sounds across the attic from me, sounds that were coming closer. At the same time, the male owner of the home yelled up to me, Do you hear footsteps? I turned on my flashlight and shocked the squirrel, rolling a big nut across the floor. He or she scampered away through a hole I found. Then I found a pile of nuts nearby. It seems odd acoustics were to blame for the bouncing nut to be heard as footsteps. To test my hypothesis, I rolled a nut across the floor. Footsteps! Yelled the owners. To further test, I grabbed a handful of the nuts and rolled them all across the floor at once. The couple responded with more yelling and a little screaming, asking if I was okay. I came down from the attic, at which point they looked at me suspiciously. I explained the acoustics and had to take them up one at a time, the other remaining below, to show them how it all worked, as well as to point out the squirrel's entry point. You may wonder why I did the test with a handful of nuts, especially since it was going to freak out the homeowners, and did, of course. Sometimes, you just have to do something to entertain yourself in these investigations. Lloyd Auerbach, January 13, 2023. For more information, if you're at all interested in finding out more about psychic phenomena in general, psychic abilities, ghostly encounters, and research on all of this, the kinds of things that Jennifer and Nate encountered in this book, in the first in the series, Near Death, and in future investigations, check out these organizations as your starting points. They are credible, provide excellent information and learning opportunities, and are ones I am proud to be part of, or a member of, in the case of the SPR. Rhine Research Center, www.rhine.org. The longest-running lab and educational organization in the United States, this is the legacy of the Duke University Parapsychology Laboratory, founded in the 1930s. The Rhine has a huge media library, videos of lectures by researchers, psychics, and others presented over the last few years. There are a few that are free, but you are encouraged to join, not only to gain access to the media library and get discounts on webcasts of new lectures and discounts on classes and other things, but mainly to help support the work of the Rhine. The Rhine Education Center, www.rhineedu.org, offers online courses throughout the year. Lloyd Auerbach is one of the main instructors and loves teaching through the Rhine. The Society for Psychical Research, www.spr.ac.uk. The SPR is the oldest psychical research and parapsychology organization, founded in 1882. Lots of good info here for free, especially the PSI Encyclopedia, https://psi-encyclopedia.spr.ac.uk, an ever-growing resource on psychic abilities and research. The Forever Family Foundation, www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Free to join, this nonprofit supports the work of evidential mediums in the family grieving process and supports scientific research into experiences suggestive or supportive of the concept of survival of consciousness, and Lloyd Auerbach is the current president. Follow Lloyd Auerbach on Twitter at Prof Paranormal. Subscribe to his YouTube channels at www.youtube.com/user/LloydAuerbach, LloydAuerbach/videos. www.youtube.com/user/profparanormal/videos. Or you can reach Lloyd Auerbach via email at profparanormal@gmail.com. Author's note. If you've read Near Death, and if you haven't, you should, the author's note shares the long history of Nate Rainey and Jennifer Day from pitch to pilot script to novel in detail. It's also available on our website, RaineyandDay.com. Rich, Lloyd, and I have been thrilled with the response to the first book, which included several comments that the project would make a great streaming or television series. Huh, may have to look into that. There was a huge sense of completion when Near Death was finished. But now Afterlife is here, bringing Nate and Jennifer and their colleagues to new places. It's an exciting step that opens up myriad possibilities and brings Rainey and Day to life in a way they never have been before. After almost 3 decades, they are investigating a new case, albeit an old case, fitting for their own history. And they will soon be back in their third adventure, Farsight. We hope you continue to follow their investigations, and that their experience, and ours, is living and dying proof that almost anything is possible. Especially Arnold Rudnick, January 13, 2023. Acknowledgements. My ongoing gratitude to the earliest fans of the Rainy and Day novels, who continue to help shape and refine the story and characters into something I hope you all enjoy. Thank you to Catherine Rudnick, Sheila Smith, and Jen Meir. Also, huge thanks to Nina Henderson for all her time and effort to make this a better book. For Afterlife, we also recruited a launch team of fans of the first book to help us spread the word about this latest volume. You all know who you are, and I am extremely grateful for your enthusiastic help. If you're interested in getting early access to the next Rainy Day investigation and participating in reader outreach, contact us on Facebook at Rainy and Day or at rainyandday.com. I also want to thank the Reader's Favorite organization, which sponsors an annual contest in addition to publishing excellent reviews. We are honored to have received a bronze medal in the category of paranormal fiction for the first Rainy Day investigation, Near Death. I had the opportunity to accept the award on behalf of myself, Arnold, and Lloyd in November of 2022, and met a lot of interesting people, including a gentleman who was kind enough to relate his own near-death experience, elements of which may just find their way into a future story. Rich Hosick, January 13, 2023. Afterlife would not exist if it weren't for our lead author, Rich Hosick, who forewent sleep and numerous hours of binge television to handle the heavy lifting on this book, and whom I must acknowledge first and last. We are also indebted to Lloyd Auerbach, not only for his creative input, but for his paranormal expertise, ensuring Nate and Jennifer's investigations never make the reader wonder, would a ghost say that? Like any creative project, I cannot imagine its birth without the support of my wife, Catherine, not only for her moral support, but for proofreading and bringing an immense knowledge of literature to ensure our books deliver to the most discerning of readers. It takes a village to build a book, or a movie, or a building for that matter, and there are many more who made this book and series possible. But the final acknowledgement is to you, our readers, who make this worthwhile. Arnold Rudnick, January 13, 2023. First, and once again, I must acknowledge my two co-authors, Rich Hosick and Arnold Rudnick, especially Rich, for taking on the huge task of writing. I also need to acknowledge my mentors and influences who are gone from our plane of existence, Martin Caden, Annette Martin, Marcello Truzzi, D. Scott Rogo, Alex Tanis, Carlos Osis, my uncle Herb Norman, and my father, Dick Auerbach, and one that's still here, thankfully, Ed May. All of them, and a litany of others, had real influence on my career in parapsychology, and often on my parallel career as psychic entertainer, Professor Paranormal, as well as my work with the media. I also have to thank John Kruth, Executive Director of the Rhine Research Center, for his continual support and friendship, especially when it comes to the online courses I teach for the Rhine Education Center, as well as my Rhine students, many of whom support my every other week Facebook Live sessions with their attendance and questions. The Executive Board and Certified Mediums of the Forever Family Foundation, especially Bob Ginsburg and Lee Harris, for their incredible work with this all-volunteer nonprofit organization, and all my other colleagues in the field of parapsychology and the world of psychic entertainment. Phew. Lloyd Auerbach, January 13, 2023. You've reached the end of Afterlife, a Rainy Day investigation. Jennifer and Nate's first adventure, Near Death, is also available on Amazon, Audible, and other online retailers in print, ebook, and audiobook form. We invite you to also tune into Rich Hosick's fiction podcast, Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs, available on your favorite podcast app or on Audible. You can find out more at bedtimestories.studio. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Afterlife, a Rainy Day investigation, on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs fiction podcast. Remember to subscribe, share, rate, and review not only this podcast, but the novel you are currently listening to. The links to Amazon, Audible, and Goodreads are in the description for this episode. You can sign up for the Insomniacs newsletter at bedtimestories.studio and get a free bookmark. And if you want to know more about the Rainy Day Investigations Paranormal Mystery Book Series, visit rainyandday.com. That's RaineyandDaye.com. You can find out more about the host of Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs at richhosick.com. Thanks again, and all the very best.